Welcome to the Shake Up the World podcast. We have with us Mehdi Yacoubi. So Mehdi is an engineer and entrepreneur from Paris. He is passionate about optimizing health, longevity and well-being and is currently building a solution to help people optimize their metabolic health, prevent chronic diseases and live healthier and longer lifestyle. More on that later.
Yeah, so maybe I happen to go through all your work which you've done so far, all your website, your Twitter feeds and all the articles you've written, also the newsletter. It's just like, there's a lot. I kind of consumed your information like an Informa board or something. And then I just kind of had a really nice time. And I really enjoyed it, in fact. So that's something which I want to share first and foremost.
Thank you so much, Reyes. I really appreciate it.
So Mehdi, I just wanted to start with this one thing which you have mentioned in the website. So you had mentioned this quote which really got me intrigued. So it was something along the lines of the way you do anything is the way you do everything. As in, why is this a life-changing quote for you in some sense? And what does it mean to you?
So that's a very good question, because actually it was really a life-changing quote in my life. The idea behind the quote, I think the idea is pretty clear. So, I'm going to maybe tell you how it impacted me. So, you know, like when you start doing certain things, some things that you're doing can appear as not very important, or something might be in your mind more important than what you're currently doing. But I think that when you really give all of your energy to what you're currently doing, even if it's something super simple like going for groceries or just going for a walk or giving a present to a friend. So if you do this little thing in a very good way, you're always going to have amazing experiences in your life, and it's going to lead you to a very, very great place. So this is the idea of even the small things, even the things that you don't want to do, if you do them in a great way, it's going to bring you so much more than if you just want to rush them. So, you know, if you want to be a person that does great things, you have to do these great things, even in the small things. So the way you do anything is the way you do everything.
I also really like the quote which you pulled from Simone de Beauvoir. You mentioned something along the lines of what Simone mentions about how she says that I'm awfully greedy. I want everything from life. And I think that kind of summarizes as well the way your approach is, because I see that you are interested in a wide variety of topics, right? From longevity research to fitness and psychology. And that's kind of shown in the newsletter which you have as well. So maybe it would be nice to just go theme by theme in terms of the themes which interest you. And maybe we can just go into a deep dive into those topics.
Yeah, so for sure.
I was just, maybe it could be nice to introduce the audience in terms of your startup first and foremost, and what is the vision which you have, and then we can start from there and develop further.
Yeah, so actually I'm currently working on Lifetizer, which is the product that I'm building. It's a solution to help people optimize their blood glucose levels for everyone, not only for people with diabetes. We want to make blood glucose levels optimization available for all, because that's the way to prevent the burden of metabolic diseases. And that's the way to stay optimized and stay in great health and also optimize for longevity. So right now that's what we're building, and we're developing the solution with our first early users. They're loving it, and we're taking it from here. The idea that led me to this project was basically that the way we handle health right now is completely in the reverse way. Like everyone goes to the doctor when there is a problem, but there is nothing to improve what you already have, or to make sure that it stays good. So it's this idea of bringing health in your lifestyle and making it part of your everyday life. So health is not only when there is a problem, health is a way of life. And so we want to bring this new way of life and this new preventive medicine mindset with this first solution with the blood glucose levels. And From there, the goal is to add many other verticals on the solution to basically help people optimize their whole health with our products.
So in terms of your approach, a couple of questions just come in my mind while going through your work. So one is in terms of the approach itself, right? So normally we come to our doctors or physicians when we have like broken our back or fractured our leg or have some ailment, right? And we come to kind of cure the disease. But as far as I've seen, this is more in terms of preventing what's going to happen in the future and making sure that your health and you use data in a sense to make sure that these things are avoided in the future, right? If I'm not wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, basically it's shifting the efforts from a mindset where you're fixing a problem to a mindset where you used this energy and those effort, but before it's too late, before you have the problem, and you just make it part of your everyday life. So like instead of going to the doctor when you already have a disease, maybe you're gonna focus in improving your lifestyle, improving your habits, and that will lead to better outcomes.
I also had seen your tweet about this, that you mentioned that it's quite unfortunate that it's just the diabetic who are kind of getting used to such tools for blood glucose monitoring, right? So any thoughts on this regard as to how blood glucose monitoring could actually help us to up our game and to gain more insights as to how our body functions? So any thoughts on that?
Yeah. This is exactly the problem that we're going through, is that we have a lot of tools, but the problem is that we kept the old mindset. So right now, the people that are monitoring their blood glucose levels are people with diabetes. But what we have to understand is that type 2 diabetes is a disease that you develop through your life. It's not black and white. You develop it through years of bad habits and bad nutrition. Of course, there are some genetic factors. Some people will develop it much easier than others, but it's not something that you're born with. It's something that you develop through life. So the idea is to take the problem before it becomes a big problem. So if you can see, like years before developing the diabetes, that you're going on the wrong direction, you can change this direction. And you can have a massive impact on your future health, like, and you can obviously prevent these diabetes. So if you want a clear example, I started monitoring my blood glucose levels around a year ago. And I was extremely shocked to see that actually I'm almost pre-diabetic. So my blood glucose levels are really not optimal. And I'm someone that really pay attention to what I eat, and I try to exercise a lot. So it shows you that it's not only the big bad habits like fast foods and this kind of stuff. You can really develop bad metabolism without having necessarily a bad lifestyle. So
a healthy person could still have, say, pre-diabetic levels, even if they are really not monitoring it, that could be dangerous, yeah, for them, right?
Exactly. So for example, me and my co-founder, we are actually both of us almost pre-diabetic, and we're like really healthy people. You would never guess that we are going to be pre-diabetic people. So this is the idea, you know, and when people around me started to track their blood glucose levels, a lot of people found out that their levels are really not optimal. So, you know, if you don't pay attention to it, you won't have very good blood glucose levels.
So, just going a bit deeper into this personal journey of yours while you were using this device, right? Like, how does it look like? Or is it something which is strapped onto your arm?
Yeah.
And could you just tell a bit more about that, and also in terms of what inferences you could gain from actually tracking the data, and how was there a difference in your own lifestyle after you got insight which you wanted?
For sure. So it's a sensor that you can put on your arm, and basically the sensor gives you your blood glucose levels in real time. And the idea is to understand how certain things in your life impact your blood glucose levels, mainly things like nutrition, activity, sleep, this is basically what you want to understand. You want to understand the correlations between these things and your blood glucose levels. So the first thing is to understand where you are, you know, like, do you have already very good blood glucose levels, or are you in a place where you can progress? Or you might discover that you're in a place where you really have to pay attention. So after understanding where you stand, then you can start understanding the impacts of what you eat and your exercise on your metabolism. So on my side, I discovered that my breakfast, basically the meal that I was eating every day, the first meal that I was eating every day, was very bad for my blood glucose levels. So to give you an example, in my case, it was an extreme example, but basically I was
mentioned about oats not being good for you, although it is commonly accepted.
So
that it's actually healthy, right?
Again, what I want to say is not that something is bad for everyone, but it's just that people need to try for themselves. The era of one size fits all needs to stop, because one size fits one. It doesn't fit everyone. And we need to understand that people are different and metabolism are different. So for me, I was having a rather big bowl of oats as a first meal. So it's something that most people would consider healthy, but it was spiking my blood glucose levels from around 100 to 200. So it's a massive, massive, massive spike. And I was having that on the daily basis. So you can imagine that eating that for a few years, it's going to really have deleterious effects on your metabolism. So, you know, for me, I changed a lot in the way that I eat. And people around me as well understood that certain foods are bad for them and some others are really good. The idea, again, is not to say this precise food like oats are bad. This is not the point. The point is just for people to understand what works for them, which is not going to be the same as what works for another person.
So the diet, in a sense, has to be personalized to how your body is, because each one is different in their own way.
Exactly. Right? Basically, it's not a new idea. You know, like people always knew that we need to personalize things. But before, it was not possible to personalize because we did not have the technology to do so. Right now we have biosensors that can give us real-time accurate feedback to understand what's happening within our body. And this understanding can bring the new era of personalization. And right now is the time to start it, you know? Now is the time to change the way we do and do it with a more personalized mindset.
So I could also see a lot of these startups coming up with using data in a sense to make the person more aware, right? Like I could also see a lot of these measurement devices for sleep tracking and also for other vital parameters, and your company being especially involved with blood glucose monitoring. So I have a question a bit more on the broader sense of measurement of these vital parameters in general. I'll just play a bit more of this intellectual sparring partner, just being on the opposite side and asking a very fundamental question. That is, of course, we do measure this. Let's say we get this in data as to this is how it is. If say we are sleeping for 7 hours or 8 hours and we are going to track that and we come to know about this insight, isn't it still the agency is still on the individual to make an action, right? That is, say we come to know about this insight and it has to be implemented. For instance, what I'm trying to say is, say if we have a measuring scale or a weighing machine, you measure your weight, but you still have, it doesn't really make you say slimmer or more healthier, right? It can give you information, but how does that work? Like how can you bring about that agency in the individual, even though they are measuring or tracking through these sensor-based devices?
That's a very good question. That's actually the most important question in the field.
How do we bring about that agency back to the individual?
Exactly. So, you know, as you say, like these tools give you information. Mm-hmm. They give you an understanding of the situation. They can help you get in a good place. But in the end, the person still needs to do the thing. You know that you need to exercise, you need to do certain things. This solution can help you really find the right thing for you, the thing that's going to be optimal. So for example, the minimum amount of a certain things that will still be fine for you, or it can really give you this granular level of information that is still a very good addition to what we could have before. But in the end, as you said, it remains on the person to do it. However, there is something powerful in those solution is that the fact of tracking is a behavioral tool. What do I mean by that? I mean that on top of the information, the fact of knowing that you will have the information pushes you to want to get a good information. So for example, if you track your sleep, it will not fix your sleep, but it will make you aware of the problem. Like, okay, last night I had 5 hours of sleep. I see that my rings of sleep are red. I had only 1 hour of deep sleep. So during the day, I will have this information, and maybe when it's going to be 8 the day after, I'm going to say, okay, maybe now it's time for me to relax a little bit and try to go to bed early because I have the information and I know that it was good. So it gives you this quick feedback that something was not good, and it can help you as a behavioral tool to do the right thing. For CGMs and blood glucose levels as well, what I discovered and what many different people discovered is that, you know that many different foods are bad for you. But when you really see the damage that you're doing to your body, like you see a massive spike, or you see, you know, that you're basically damaging your body, you don't want to do it. You know, it's a very, very potent behavioral tool. Like, people keep telling me the same thing. Like, you know, when I wear a CGM, I don't want to do, you know, I don't want to do like this random thing that I know is bad for me. Like, I think two times before doing it. So it can help a lot of people like that, because as you said in your question, you know, like, there is the information and then there is the behavior. So we have to act on both sides to have really, really a good impact on people. And with this information, we also have this behavioral tool, and that what makes this new era very powerful.
Very interesting, Mehdi. Just along the same lines, touching upon this aspect of what you mentioned, where you're talking about the blood glucose levels, right? So you do have some variance of the levels. Say there could be some spikes as well, right? And there is also an optimal range where the blood glucose has to be maintained, which is good for us. So even if there is a spike, does it really mean anything? I'm just being a very completely not well-researched on this topic, but just want to know your perspective on this front. That wouldn't it be okay to have some spikes here and there, or just is it like really required to have this range? Like, I think Nazim Taleb puts it in, he calls it the Procrustean bed. I don't know if you have read the story of the Procrustean bed.
I did not.
Just an example, but maybe if you could connect with. So he talks about this inn where people come and give a visit, and there is this innkeeper who makes sure that the person who's sleeping in the bed fits exactly to the size of the bed. So for instance, if the person is too big, he cuts his legs to make sure that he fits to this bed. And if he's too short, he stretches the body to fit onto the bed. So I'm just wondering if it's another Procrustean bed where you are maintaining the levels in the range, but volatility is not kind of exercise. So let's say these spikes, would it really affect the person? I'm just being a completely, not an expert in this field, but just want to know your view.
For sure. Well, Shreyas, it's actually a very good question. You know, like, and the way I look at this question is actually by asking what's the goal. You know, what's the goal of what we're doing? There are multiple goals. You know, there is the goal of right now. I want to feel better. I want to sleep better. I want to have more energy, and this is a goal that you can feel. You can see if you're okay with a certain amount of spikes. You can see where you want to put your limits. So these are the levels that I have when I feel good, and then you can target those. And then you have the additional goal, which is longevity. This goal, you do not feel it because it's something that will happen in a few decades. So metabolic health is one of the biggest pillar of longevity. And basically right now in the current situation, before we develop therapies for radical life extension that I hope are going to come soon.
Yeah,
right now,
a hot topic which I would, I mean, that's something which got me interested to have this conversation with you in the
first. For sure.
That would be an interesting segue after this.
Yeah. So right now, the situation is that, you know, living a long and healthy life is equivalent to delaying the onset of chronic diseases. And to do so, researchers and doctors understood that to delay the onset of these chronic diseases, the biggest diseases that kill the most of us, you need to have a perfectly optimized metabolism. So it's still a relatively new field to understand what's a perfectly optimized metabolism. But we have to start somewhere. We already have pretty good ideas of what are the optimal levels to target. And this science is going to continue evolving to help us target the right values for each one of us. So this is obvious. Yeah, tell me.
I've been like, right now we've been having this question. I've been asking like, why? And it slowly leads to this grander vision of, say, life extension, longevity, and immortality or whatnot, right? So I see this vision which you have.
And exactly. So
expand a bit on those lines.
Let's be clear here. Like, so optimizing metabolism is basically what's going to enable a person to be in great health and prevent the onset of chronic diseases in the best way, you know? So it's the thing that if you want to remain disease-free for as long as possible, you want to pay very, very good attention to it, because most of the diseases that kill people are related to a metabolic problem. Then, like, on another side, which is not necessarily related to that, but this thing got me really interested in longevity. I really have a passion for longevity and for this thinking of life extension.
In your long game newsletter.
Exactly. That's why I called the newsletter the long game.
Nice. Yeah. Sorry, you were saying something.
Yeah. And so, you know, this got me really interested in the field of longevity. And, you know, I really do think that most people are not aware that a lot of scientists are actually working on this question of life extension. And they're currently working on reversing aging. It's not about slowing down aging right now. It's about reversing aging. So it's really something crazy when you think about it. It's like,
the first question which pops into anyone's mind right now is like, what, like how, and is it really possible or is it science fiction? I mean, what are the facts on the table, right? These are the first questions which come to anyone's mind who's just wondering if this is even this sounds really crazier than reality in a sense, right?
It does sound crazy, and actually the first really pillar to understand this thing is that scientists and researchers understood that aging itself is the big disease. So by switching our understanding from aging as a normal part of life to aging as a disease that we could fight, it changes everything. I don't know if you're familiar with the dragon tyrant, with the fable of the dragon tyrant, mm-hmm. which is this story where, you know, throughout history, you know, in this old village, people were delivering people to this gigantic dragon up until the moment in which they understood that maybe they could fight the dragon. And this is a metaphor to talk about aging. And this is actually, I love this story because it really gives you the problem right now with longevity, is that we have to find the culprit. We have to find the thing that we need to fight. And this thing is aging itself. It is a disease, and researchers are now trying to reverse aging. And actually, aging is a loss of information, nothing more than that. So
would you expand a bit on those lines? Like how is it loss of information, and why is aging another disease? I mean, it seems so obvious that everything ages, everything becomes dead. Every living organism in a sense becomes dead after some time, right? And that's an essence of life when there is death. But yeah, this is very contrary to that whole perspective. So could you touch upon those?
For sure. Well, you know, we're not talking yet about immortality or anything right now. You know, we need to remain when you look at what's happening. So with the latest science, they manage to reverse the biological age of mice. Yeah, of the mice. So, you know, it's just to show that by triggering the right thing in these living organisms, they manage to do something as crazy as reversing aging. So there is something that can be done there. And actually, David Sinclair explains that in Lifespan, is that if you manage to fix the loss of information, you can actually reverse aging. And right now, the approach, as Aubrey de Grey explained it in a very good interview, is that many different teams are working on reversing aging in different parts of the body. So some people, for example, are working on stem cells for the muscles. Some people are working on, you know, how to create new organs if there is a problem with an organ. And so right now, this is a little bit where the science is. There is, of course, a lot to be done because this is a tremendous project. And there is not a lot. The problem right now is that there is not a lot of funding in the field. So, you know, if you compare it to a field like cancer or another field of medicine, really the funding is ridiculous. And to get more funding and to really get great results, it has to go with a mindset shift, you know, people understanding that this gigantic thing that is aging and that we accepted for centuries, millennia, is actually something that we can do something to fight. We can do something.
I think Balaji also mentions in the North Star podcast that I think the final battle which technology could eventually overcome is in terms of extension
exactly.
of life. And that's probably like the most important battle which we should fight.
Exactly. Because the purpose of technology is to reduce scarcity. And the ultimate scarcity is time. So the ultimate thing that we can do is increase the amount of time that we have. And that's why we should really put a great focus on it.
I think it's also quite obvious. Also, I read one of your newsletters where you mentioned how this whole trend towards shifting towards health, as to say, even Apple is looking at it in terms of how can you extend the life of the person so that you could extract in terms of maximum value out of a person in terms of the service they're providing, right? So life extension could be the next big thing in terms of where everyone is heading towards. But it's quite unfortunate that there's not much research funding going into life extension, which is, I would say, yeah, I mean, it's still difficult to really say for sure, right? You need to look at it in a decades span to really know if this really works or not. So I'm really curious to know how this would eventually progress in terms of research.
So, you know, like, this is a good question. And right now, there is quite a good consensus in the aging field that, you know, we could do much better than the current maximum of lifespan that we have, which is 100 and around 120 years old. So, you know, like, these scientists know that we could do much better. So, you know, if you really zoom out and look at the big picture, you know that, you know, in, let's say, you know, a few thousand years, it's going to be radically different. You know, we're going to do much better than that. So the point is just, are we going to be the first generation to really have a massive improvement of the situation? Or are we going to be one of the last generation to only have the current situation that there is, you know, to only have a life of around 80 to 100 years?
Unfortunate ones to have kind of had a limited lifespan, right? And the next generation could be...
Exactly. So, you know, the thing is that we are the main protagonist of this story, you know, like with our efforts, with our research, with defending, with our efforts, with our communication, we can change the whole situation, you know? Like, for example, if you imagine like these big projects that we had in the 20th century, like the Manhattan Project, for example, or the Apollo program, like these were massive, massive efforts directed toward one goal, you know, go to the moon, develop the atomic bomb. And these programs managed to do such incredible innovations. That's a little bit sad for the atomic bomb that everything was put to the power of destruction. But it's just to show how we can be so innovative and we can be so fast on specific issues if we put the right resources and the right focus. So, you know, if we manage to really progress on these topics, we might do it, you know, we might do it soon.
Actually, I was reading about this a couple of weeks back, pretty fascinating that from the time we discovered the neutron and to the time we had implemented the Manhattan Project and made the first, dropped the first atom bomb, right? It was just a period of, I think, 13 to 15 years, if I'm not wrong, which is quite small in terms of overall implementation, right? From the discovery to the execution, right? And that too for something as massive as atomic bomb.
Exactly.
So I can only imagine if, let's say, the Manhattan Project for aging comes to reality, and maybe this age reversing of mice is the first step towards making this reality possible. I was just thinking about those lines, in fact.
I was thinking about it, you know, like this is what I wrote in the newsletter this week. I was thinking about it a lot. And, you know, the problem is that, you know, we still have a geopolitical context, you know. It's like in the same time that we want to improve the technology, improve the life, there is a geopolitical context where countries need to be aware of it. And, you know, like the best way not to have any war is to prepare for war. You know, it's like you need to always remain ready. So the problem is that to translate these gigantic programs like Apollo or Manhattan to something like aging is hard because, you know, it's not for something like it could be, you know, this is the thing that I was thinking of. It's like, it's not obvious that it's going to be like a gigantic strategic win for the country. But if you really think about it, you know, you might find out that it's actually a very, very big strategic win if you manage to really improve the health span of a country. So that's a little bit the difference that I see there, that when it's for military use or, you know, cultural, like going to the moon, it gives to the project more energy and more, you know, there is something more there. Yeah.
I think it needs the right incentive structures to actually fast track the whole process. But I'm just really curious about how the future roadmap looks like. Like for now, I see fitness, and then you have, say, nutrition and, say, reduced aging itself. And then you have age reversing and then immortality. So if you just go completely bonkers and think of a futuristic scenario, very optimistic scenario of a future. So how do you think all these things fall into place? Like, I mean, you were also mentioning the other day about this longevity, escape, velocity. So how does all these things connect and bring together?
So there are a lot, of course, of uncertainty about the future, but
an optimistic front, like
if you want to be optimistic,
a white mirror, right?
Yeah, a white like a magic mirror, let's say. Yeah. So if you want to be optimistic about the future, which I am, how it might look like is that first it's going to be the era of health optimization. So you know, from 2020 to maybe 10 or 15 years, we're really gonna get better at optimizing health with what we have, you know? Correlations between nutrition, sleep, exercise, mindfulness, like all of these things, we're gonna be able to get a much better understanding and much better optimization of our body. On top of that, you know, once you start optimizing the body, you know, then are going to come, you know, things like biomarkers, like aging biomarkers. You know, people already do it. Track aging biomarkers and try to optimize them. There is also the biological clock that gives you your real age, not your chronological age, that you can also work to optimize, you know, like maybe you're 50 years old, but your biological age might be 45, you know?
Have you seen this in most of these gyms as well, right? You can really see what's your actual age as compared to your, I mean, the metabolic age, in fact, and that kind of helps you to be more aware of where you stand, right?
Exactly, exactly. So these are going to be tools that are going to be instrumental in improving and optimizing health. But, you know, all of that is going to be like very good to improve the health span and, you know, hopefully stay in great health for as long as possible. But this will not create a revolution in what we can do. It might, you know, improve for the people that are doing all of that, you know, it might improve the result, but this is not what is going to give a completely different result. You know, what could give a completely different result are, you know, life extension therapies that we were talking just earlier.
That's like cryogenics and so on, right? Like in terms
of. So, you know, a lot of different of new therapies are coming. And, you know, we might imagine that in a few decades, some of these therapies are going to be ready. And the way that I like to think about it is that you have to put time on your side. So you basically have to make sure that you remain in good health, because maybe, you know, maybe in 2050 or in 2060, those therapies are going to exist. So imagine if at that time you're in poor health, or you're already with chronic diseases and you cannot use those therapies. So imagine, you know, like it would be really one of the, you know, like you would really be mad at yourself if it would be very unfortunate to be there. So, you know, you always have to keep in mind that when the time passes, like technology will also progress a lot. So if you imagine in 10 years, you have to imagine that researchers have worked more for 10 years. If you think 20 years, well, again, 20 years research on top of what we currently have. So that's how I like to think about it.
Oh, it's quite interesting. So let's try to zoom in on the present. And I guess we have covered grounds in terms of what the potential of this technology and what the plans your company itself is going about with. So in your newsletters, you also mentioned a lot about fasting and the benefits of cold showers and something along those lines. So, I've also kind of started using this Zero app, which is quite nice for fasting. So I'm just getting interested in it. And I'm pretty intrigued because I personally have tried implementing fasting in my lifestyle, but have like failed miserably because I couldn't really control myself to not eat for certain times. So what is your experience with fasting and what are the changes you have seen in your own lifestyle? Yeah.
So I really love fasting. Like I got into fasting maybe 5 years ago or 4 years ago, and I really enjoy it. Like I have always been a person, you know, I enjoy moments where I eat, and I'm really completely fine with not snacking and not eating for a long time. So, you know, like maybe 2 years ago, I started, I started with 16-8 intermittent fasting, and then I increased it to 20 hours of fasting per day. And it was really without any, I was not struggling at all. Like for me, it was easy. For some people, I know that it's hard, but for me, it's very easy because I managed to get all of my calories rather quickly. So I don't have a problem with big portions. So on this side, it's a little bit easy for me. And I also got into a more extended fasts, and I did multiple 3-day fasts. And again, here,
like 72 hours, right?
72 hours. Yeah. 72 hours.
It's a bit insane. Like how did you manage 72 hour fast?
You know, it's really psychological. So the first day is really easy. When you're used to do 20 hour fast per day, the first day is very easy. The first night is very easy. The second day, at the end of the second day is a little bit hard, but then it gets easier. And then the third day, sometimes it can get a little bit challenging, but most of the time it's fine. You know, it's really a mental exercise. What I usually suggest to people that want to get into it, you know, they of course they obviously need to be healthy and without any health condition, but is to try, you know, first intermittent fasting, you know, like try 16, mm-hmm. try 20, you know, then maybe try 36. 36 is the monk fast. It's really good to get used to more extended fasts. And then you can try, you know, maybe try with a friend. You know, at the first 72 hours, I did it with my co-founder. And, you know, we were together, we were working on Lifetizer. And, you know, it was hard, but when you're with someone, it makes the whole process much easier. So, you know, this social aspect of these practices are really important, I feel.
In terms of accountability, right? So,
yeah,
exactly. I think it's applicable for even fitness or gymming as well.
For everything.
Gymming partners and running partners and so on.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And the thing that I would add on fasting is that, you know, again, I said earlier that there is no one size fits all. And again, here, you know, like I love fasting, you know, I really love it, but it doesn't work for everyone. Like, for example, on my personal experience, I discovered that when I was fasting, my blood glucose levels were quite high and I had a very bad response after refeeding. So when I was eating after fasting, my blood glucose levels were, yeah. And they stayed high for a long time, like really bad response, you know? And even if I reduced to the minimum the amount of carbohydrates that I was having to break my fast, it, you know, it just didn't work for me. So I had to, you know, find something that works. And the idea is just to, for people to try, you know, to have these self-experimentation processes in their life to, you know, if you want to try something, try it. Stay, try to try things once at a time. Like you cannot try, you know, everything in the same time. So you can isolate what is good and what is bad. And like that, you know, it's a journey.
Used for various purposes as well, right? Like say,
yeah.
There could be people who do fasting for the gut or fasting for, let's say, increasing the lifespan or in terms of reducing fat as well. So I see there are various outcomes which could come out of fasting itself.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think Peter Attia has also done phenomenal work in terms of fasting and making it so mainstream that it's so accessible for people to understand.
Exactly. Yeah.
I have a question in this regard though. So with the 72-hour fast, do you not consume anything at all, or is it just certain things which you can still consume?
Well, you know, there are some people that are quite religious about it. I'm not. So, you know, for me, I was just taking some salt, some water, just to get those electrolytes in the body. Some magnesium also a little bit. You know, people do it in the way that they want to do it, you know, like, then it might be different if you want to heal your gut or, you know, if you just want to have the first experience, but yeah, you know, like I don't, you know, some people are hardcore. You need to drink only water and take nothing else. I think, you know, we should be more open to different styles. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So Mehdi, maybe we'll have a fresh perspective here and talk about something completely different. Being a polymath, I guess you have a wide variety of interests as well. So I'm really interested to know what has really influenced you in terms of the way you think. It could be in terms of books. So are there any such books which you think are the most influential? Like maybe it could be like one or two books or maximum three, which you might consider that this is a part of you and it's something which you reflect in your daily life.
Yeah. Well, actually there are a lot of different things, and maybe the what's important to me is the way that I approach learning and life in general. Like I just try to optimize for what I find interesting, you know, like if I find something, if I find an article and I find it interesting, I'll read it. If I see a book and I find that it's interesting, I'll read it. And my interest just guides me. I just follow the interest.
Pressure, you mean. just make sure that it organically comes out rather
exactly.
than forced to do certain things in some way.
Exactly. And I have different phases, you know, like in certain moments, I really want to learn about a specific topic. So I'll learn about this topic. But generally speaking, I just like a lot of things, you know, like I it's just my way of life. Like, as you see in the newsletter, like, and it's really like that in my week. Like when I have some free time or when I have blocks where I learn new stuff, I just follow my interest. A lot of the time, there are some patterns that are coming back, you know, like general stuff that I'm generally interested in. But I also like to sometimes just when I find something that is really weird or that I don't necessarily know about or have no idea about, I'll just get interested in it. Like I'm gonna think, okay, so I have no idea about this thing. I see some people talking about it, or, you know, I heard about it in a podcast, or, you know, I read something in a book that was talking about something, and I'll just generally go and read something about it, you know? So that's how I approach learning. I still think that there is a risk with this approach is just to be just on the surface of everything. So, you know, I do think that you still have to have some topics.
Going wide and going deep, right?
There's exactly.
Such a paradox that you need to be the jack of all trades, but you also have to be master of something to have food in some place. And
exactly. So I was listening to Josh Waitzkin last time on the Ferris show, and you know this
of I think he's both an athlete as well as a mental.
He's a chess champion. Yeah, and he's a jiu-jitsu Brazilian jiu-jitsu champion, and now he's doing something with he's surfing big waves. I think, but he's a very incredible human being because he's
also not on internet as well, right? I guess he just has a website, but he's pretty much not active at all, and he has a less interesting life.
He's not on social media, and he's a fascinating person. You know, he's really fascinating because you really see the person embodying, you know, depth versus width, you know, like he's going deep in certain topics. I don't think that it's the only way to do, but I still think that there is something to learn there. Like you have to maybe find a few things where you want to go deeper than the average, you know, and maybe be in the maybe top 5% of a few things, you know, and you know, Eric Thornberg has a very good article about personal modes, and you know he explains like how some people manage to create modes. And you know, if you want to be generalist, you can be generalist, but you still have.
Could you please elaborate on that, like in terms of modes? Is it more like your strengths?
Yeah. So basically, like you know, we talk a lot of time of what's the mode of a company. And here it's on a personal level, like people, you know, things that are really hard to reproduce, basically, you know, what makes that Tyler Cohen, for example, is Tyler Cohen. What makes that Tim Ferriss is Tim Ferriss, you know, these people that really have something. And, you know, some people are generalists, but they are deep in a few things. Some, like, when you know, a person like Tyler Cohen, like he knows almost everything, but he's also an economist, you know, he's like he's extremely knowledgeable in economy.
Also Joe Rogan, I mean, if you have done like 1,000 podcasts, so his skill of in terms of talking to people on any topic whatsoever is phenomenal.
Exactly.
Become experts at certain fields, right?
Joe Rogan is a great example. You know, he knows a lot of things. He's a specialist in you know, UFC, you know, a few other topics, and he's just maybe an expert, you can say, in discussion. That's a way to see it, you know. But yeah, that's a good point.
But yeah, what I really liked about Josh Waitzkin is, I mean, he could really transfer his mental model in terms of physical outcome, in terms of jiu-jitsu, to something which is completely mental as well, right? Like both chess as well as jiu-jitsu, and being an expert in both is quite phenomenal. That kind of translates.
he mastered the art of learning and becoming an expert at something. And I really like his philosophy because, you know, you have to put this effort in understanding how you're going to get from point A to point B. And, it's not easy to become a master at something. And he knows it. And he deconstructs the skill. You know, he deconstructs, you know, in jiu-jitsu, he's going to deconstruct the positions and just practice one stuff for a year. And then he's going to be a master of this thing. You know, he said, you know, I do not fear the person that has 100 different skills. I fear the person that has only one skill and mastered this skill for years, for 100 years, or I forgot the exact quote, but yeah, I think it's a quote from Bruce Lee or something. Yeah,
I think it's from Bruce Lee, I guess, right? I fear the person who has not 1,000 kicks, but one kick which has been practiced 1,000 times.
Exactly. Like, that's the one.
That's something. It's like a trap which all of us fall into, right? Like when we are as generalists, we would like to do everything, and then we kind of lose track of those core essence of what the skill which we want. Like even if it's guitar, it could be just, they say, practicing those few chords again and again and then becoming a master at it and then slowly translating to other things. So I guess it could be applied to various skills as well.
I think it's very hard in our time to resist the temptation of wanting to learn everything, because it's accessible and it's, you can see, you know, for example, on Twitter, you know, you see many, many different topics depending on the people you follow, obviously, but you see many different topics. And the skill of knowing what to focus on is going to be instrumental in our century. You know, there's going to be a huge difference between people that know where to spend their time and people that do not. And I have to admit that I'm struggling. You know, it's something that I need to work on. I need to get better at, just focusing on a few things for, let's say, six months to a year, and that's it, you know, and resisting all of the other right? Yeah, exactly.
Let's take a segue to social media, because now we are talking about distraction and having some focus, and I mean, now that we have this social dilemma creating all these murmurs and discussions, so do you have any such social media etiquette as such? Or, I mean, we're all struggling in a sense, right, to use various tools which are there at our doorstep. But have you found a way or a process which helps you to guide through this complexity of social media in terms of all the media networks like Twitter and Instagram?
This is actually a topic that I've been thinking a lot this week, because I watched Social Dilemma like 2 weeks ago. And I was listening to Tristan Harris on Sam Harris podcast yesterday, and you know, it's really a tremendous challenge of our time. You know, we're talking a lot about existential risks, but like this problem of technology that is tearing society apart is like could really quickly become an existential risk. Like people cannot hear each other anymore. People cannot accept opposing views. And it's really concerning. Like sometimes I see things on Twitter that are concerning me. Like it's really I find certain things shocking. And so on the side of first distraction of all of the social media, I only use Twitter. I don't like none of the other social medias.
I think in a sense, Twitter is a true social network, right? Because it kind of connects everyone, right? From
that's where we met, for example. That's where I met one of my co-founders. That's where I met a lot of people that I'm collaborating with on what I'm building. And
thought first, right? Ideas come first, and
exactly the person comes. It's the social media for ideas, for reading, for, you know, new friends, for work. It's actually much better than LinkedIn for work. Like LinkedIn, it's just, I don't know what it is. Like I really don't like it. I when I connect to, when I go on LinkedIn, because I have to search for something, I find it horrible. And I even added an extension, so I don't have any feed on LinkedIn. Yeah. I deleted the feed and I feel perfect now, you know, it's like without feed, it's awesome.
Yeah.
I also deleted Instagram. You know, I don't like Instagram as well. I think it's only based on appearances and, you know, and look at how my life is perfect. And I don't like that because it doesn't bring people up. It's just, it makes people feel bad about their life. And I think that it's actually a problem of social media is that it overemphasizes on success and it underemphasizes on the way to get there. You know, it's like, you know, you might be successful. You might do great things. It will take a few decades. And yes, that's just the way, you know. But when you see, you know, extreme wealth or, you know, extreme success from some people, you know, I mean, I'm extremely happy for people that are successful. You know, I wish everyone to be successful. But it's just there is something in seeing that on constantly, you know, like seeing that, also seeing people on holidays when you're not on holiday. Like, it's just, I don't find it natural to see that on a daily basis. It's like, I don't like it.
There's always someone who is wealthier than you are. There's always someone who is smarter than you, right?
And it's not a problem. The problem is just to be, the problem is just to be confronted to that on a daily basis. You know, you wake up on a Tuesday, it's raining, you know, you don't have a perfect day. It's fine. It's just normal life. And, you know, that's completely fine. But then when you have this tool where you have these edited pictures of a perfect life, like, just human brain is not made to resist the comparison, you know? It you're going to compare. And after each time that I delete Instagram, I have this good feeling, you know? I my anxiety reduces a lot, you know? I don't have any more anxiety. I just have my life. I'm happy about my life. And that's perfect, you know? Like, I'm happy about what I'm doing. And on the Twitter side, Twitter helps you grow. Twitter helps you think better. Twitter helps you meet new people, meet your future friends. Like, we met on Twitter. We had an amazing first call to talk about the Indian tech scene, you know? And that's the beauty of Twitter, is that it connects you with people that have the same interest. There are problems on Twitter because, you know, it's
a double polarization as well, right? Like, you can see all these versus this and that. So,
and even right now, like, now it's, you know, in the US, it's the climate is really the polarization reached extreme levels. Like, it's really an unhealthy place in some accounts on the platform are really toxic.
It's heavily polarized, right, in terms of the tech Twitter.
So
in like, I mean, it's fascinating that you were also listening to the Tristan Harris his name is Tristan Harris, right? If I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
Tristan Harris, Sam Harris episode of Making Sense. So I had this similar thought, which you had written down in a beautiful way in your newsletter. So, I mean, as social media itself is very much looking at eyeball time as a metric, right? So the more time you spend, the more ads they're able to kind of get money out of. So in that, he mentions this, let's say a utopian view of social media, where what if social media could kind of emphasize on the fulfillment as a metric. So if people are striving for fulfillment, wouldn't that be different, right? So everyone is achieving their goals by using, say, media for that matter. I think that was a really nice point. And maybe I think I had seen some part of it in your newsletter as well. So what are your thoughts on this front, where a utopian view of social media, if there is any?
Yeah, I think we could improve a lot our social media on many, many different aspects. Like, first of all, you didn't touch on it right now in your question, but I still think that it's a good place to start, is on the question of truth. So right now there is a huge problem with fake news and the problem of truth, you know?
We're living in this post-truth era, right? Like, exactly. What is true? I mean, who says
what
it?
Is what is the source? Exactly. Yeah. And as much as you can imagine a post-truth era, but you also see that when you're not seeking the truth, you can reach tremendous problem. Like, if there is a pandemic, you can say that there is no, but there is. Like, you can force yourself to forget it, but it's still there. And it's still killing hundreds of thousands of people. So there is a limit to the post-truth era. And, you know, like, by creating the good incentive for truth with... the for example, prediction markets are could be an amazing tool for that. Like, what Augur is doing, to you know, like bet on anything is a great thing. Like if people needed to put a monetary amount on what they believe, they will double check. You know, if retweet equals I bet $10, you read the articles, you double check, you see who wrote it. You're gonna check, is it a Russian sponsored account? Is it a Chinese sponsored account? Is it you know, like who's the person who's writing it? You know, so we can imagine things like that. You know, like this is one way of fixing the truth problem.
You're also mentioning about this iterative model, right? Like where truth is not something set in stone, where it could just evolve organically. Exactly. As and when you get new information, right? Because it's not, still requires more information to be closer to reality.
And as you said, you know, the iterative model of truth could be a solution. You know, once we understand that we were wrong, it needs to be pushed to everyone that had the first information. You know, how can we make that happen? Technology will provide solutions, but we have to seek for those solutions, and we have to understand the emergency of the problem. Like if we lose truth, look, this pandemic is not an existential risk, but a bigger pandemic could come, you know, like bigger problems could come, and we have to have functioning society, you know, where we know what is true, we understand what's happening, and it works. So then on top of that, you asked me the question of social media and how we could improve social media. And, you know, like if there was an easy answer, the question of attention is, you know, you cannot wait for companies like Facebook or Google or all of the people that literally optimize on that to stop doing it, because it's just too much money for them.
Start taking ownership of our attention, right?
Yeah.
In terms of
exactly
sacred, we need to treat that as something which we will not just give away for free.
Yeah. And, you know, another way to do that is if you manage to push people to spend their attention to do something that they would benefit from, you know, like either earning money, either learning something new. You know, you could think of something like where if people spend time, they learn something. They learn something valuable for their career, or they earn money by doing something that is valuable. So, you know, it has to, the thinking has to start with the incentive of the social media system.
So that really reminds me of another piece which you had written, and it's something which I've also been thinking about. So we are consuming a lot of information, right, through say books, articles, and so on, but how much of it is actually retained by us, and what could be the scope of things if we actually retain it better? So there was this essay by Andy Matuszak on how, on quantum computing especially, and how he kind of uses that as a means to say that if we are retaining better, then that would be something interesting as well, right? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I love thinking about that. Is that the question of retention is so important, and so few people pay attention to it. Like Andy Matuszak and Michael Nielsen are you know, extremely, extremely brilliant minds. And they put some thinking into it. You know, they put some thinking into it. So the concept is that you read a book, 6 months later, you forgot everything. Some people will try to fool themselves into thinking that, oh yeah, but now I have this deep knowledge that is now inside of me, and I remember without remembering exactly. I don't buy into that. So I just think that you forgot, basically.
Yeah, I think there was this example of like a cup with a hole here. So you're pouring in water.
Yeah.
This,
and
like,
it goes out. Exactly.
Slowly it's coming out as time passes. So not much is retained.
Yeah. And I think by doing a few switches in the way you consume information, you could get a much better outcome with what you're consuming. For example, there are many ways to doing it, but if you're using the books and the content that already exists, what you can do is obviously take notes, you know, participate in the content. Like you see something, you relate it to something else. Like, you know, you're active, you're not passive, you're active. And then on top of that, you create an active recall system, like, you know, spaced repetition, for example, where, you know, tools like Readwise are really good because it can resurface the stuff that you were reading. So, you know, you never forget it. You read this book, and every day or every other day, you get a quote from it, and it comes back, you know? And, you know, you can create a ritual where you just go through the stuff that you had. And for example, writing a newsletter for me is this process, because I just have to go through all of the things that I read and in my personal knowledge management system. And I go
have like a fine balance of input and output.
Exactly. Exactly.
Too much, and we need to also kind of say, produce some aspect of it. And
exactly.
Fine dance.
Because producing helps you consolidate, you know, when you produce something, whatever it is, you know, whether it's for yourself or you produce something for other people, it helps you consolidate the knowledge. Like, okay, I read a few pieces this week. Now I need to put some, you know, to write something. So I go through them. I remember them. I go through also the one that I read in different weeks or last month or even last year. And I remember, you know, I remind myself, oh, this one was very good. Oh, this quote, I really liked it. So I never forget it. It's always there. You know, you go through it, you go through it. So this is why I think that having this ritual of writing something or just really making sure that you go back through what you learned is so important. It's extremely important because it's going to help you connect the ideas in a way that is just, that you cannot do if you don't do that. You know, if you leave the thing to be, and you leave them to be forgotten in a place and you never go back to read them again, you That's won't have the same level of connections in your mind. You won't have it. That's talking just impossible.
Talking about writing, there was this quote which I read somewhere on Twitter, which mentioned that writing is not a final output of thinking. Writing is thinking. You're thinking That's through it. Writing, and it's more clarified in the way you write, right?
Exactly. Like every person that tried to write an article had this first moment in which they realized, I don't know what I'm saying. Like I cannot fool. Like, you can fool yourself. Like, we are professionals in fooling ourselves. Like Feynman was saying. But you know, when you write something, you cannot fool yourself because you're gonna read it. You know, you read and you see that you wrote something that doesn't make sense. So you need to go double check. You need to do more research. You need to put something that is clean, organized, and that makes sense. You need to, like, create basically thinking. So writing is thinking. There is no difference, you know. There, if you cannot write it well, you cannot think it well.
So I see right now there is like a huge surge in terms of the creator's economy, right? The passion economy, as they call it, where you see the likes of David Perel and all the few other, like Anne Lauren Cuff as well, right? So I see that you also have kind of established a base in terms of a newsletter. And now I think the Long Game podcast is coming soon. And also your essays, which you have posted on your website, your personal website as well. So where do you see this coming into shape? And what are your thoughts on this whole aspect of how we could be at the forefront in terms of the passion economy and how we could steer that, especially in terms of writing and how that all translates, right? Because it all starts with that.
Yeah. This is the era of the passion economy. There's no doubt about that. The passion economy, if you take it on a personal level, it has to start with the passion. You know, you have to, I think the good way to think about it is to just find something that you're interested in. Just find something that you're genuinely interested in and that you like doing. So, you know, if there are some topics that you find that are interesting to you, just read more about them and just, you know, write something. Maybe start with summaries, maybe start with whatever you want to start with, just start with something. And through time, through practice, you're going to, you know, your style is going to evolve. You're going to see what you enjoy doing, what you don't like doing. And, you know, you're going to elaborate your personal brand. And you don't need to start with a personal brand that's already made. You know, you can develop it through time. You know, you can develop your personal monopoly with time. You don't need to be the guy that does, you know, the psychology guy, for example. You know, you can just follow your interest and, you know, with a little bit of time, you're going to end up in the right place.
Because being a polymath, you might have multiple interests, right? You would like to talk about all those things which you are consuming.
Yeah.
But as you are saying that it slowly prunes and you kind of get a focus as well as you write more.
Exactly. And also you can also never necessarily focus on something, you know, like Joe Rogan is not a writer, but he doesn't have a focus. Like he has basically everyone on the podcast. So, you know, you don't need to think about the audience or who's going to listen or who's going to read. This is not important. This is secondary. You know, obviously you want to do something good that people might enjoy, but you shouldn't, I don't like to think about it when I'm creating something. I just, you know, try to write something that makes me think and makes me put up something that I would like to read. And that's it. If some people like it, it's perfect. If no one likes it, it's not a problem. You know, it's really not a problem.
Do you have like mentors in this regard? Like in terms of things, I mean, like people who you really admire and who have really influenced you? Like first, I think I asked about books, but now I would like to steer this conversation towards people. I think it could be even the people you have met on Twitter and on those likes, and they could be dead as well. But I mean, just in terms of all the people who have influenced you or are also having this relation which you have, which is helping you professionally and personally and so on.
Yeah, a lot of people are being influenced in my life. I must admit that I really admire a whole lot of people. You obviously have, you know, great thinkers, you know, people that go deep in specific topics. I admire them a lot, you know, like the topics that I usually find interesting. And, you know, when you hear or when you read someone that is really, you feel that there is deep knowledge in these topics, it's really beautiful. You know, it's beautiful. Like, and on top of that, I also really like people that help the conversation evolve, you know, that help people have more conversations. Like for example, Lex Fridman, you know, of the Lex Fridman podcast. I really admire Lex, you know, he's an amazing host. I learned so much through his podcast, and he's a good human being. You know, he's really, we need more people like him. You know, I also love Joe Rogan. Some people do not like certain of his views, but I think that what's important are conversations. You know, you need to get the conversation going. You know, you need to talk with people. It's not by, you know, like just not respecting or not accepting that people disagree with you. The conversation is not going to improve.
You're mentioning in terms of accepting people of opposing views as well, right? Yeah. You're just having a conversation.
Exactly.
And, I mean, yeah, that's something which I was also observing.
Exactly.
People might have disagreements in terms of the people who you have as guests for your show. But I guess it's all about conversation, and there's nothing harmful in a civilized conversation, right? Nobody's throwing stones or planting bombs for that matter.
Exactly. So, you know, I try to learn from a lot of different people, and I try to stay, you know, really open-minded. Like, and sometimes I try to find something that I disagree with and be fine with it. Because the first reaction is that you really don't like what you hear. And I think the way we can bring solutions to this complicated time is just by being fine with disagreeing, like really being fine and listening and just not being part of the problem by just wanting to cancel the other people. It's fine. We disagree and that's completely okay. And this is the way, you know, this is how we're going to continue progressing as a civilization and improve our life on this planet and maybe on other planets, you know. This is how we're going to do it.
How is it in France though? Like, what is the mood? Like, has this political polarization or polarization in general spread to Europe, the virus of wokeness?
So I'm going to be honest with you. I don't follow a lot the situation in France. I'm much more oriented towards the US. But You know, like Bruno Massais, the author of History Has Begun, you know, he's really he has strong opinion on the fact that, you know, cancel culture and the woke movement is not going to come to Europe. I think Europe is different than the US, but, you know, some of these things, not the whole movement, like exactly like in the US, but some aspects of it might come. And I suspect that some of the problems of what's happening in the US are already here in France, but it's not exactly the same. Like, you cannot compare it entirely. We have our own problems. Like, they're not the same, but they are still existent.
Well, that brings us to the end of this conversation. I guess we had a nice time, right? In terms of the topics we explored, but I'll kind of smugly come back to this topic of books, because I think our audience might be generally interested in reading things which you might be interested in as well. So if you could probably it might even not be the most influential, but maybe the books which are on top of your mind right now, or even articles for that matter. So that could be interesting for them to kind of gorge upon. So
yeah.
You have any thoughts on that?
So I have to say, like, this is good that you added articles, because I think that articles can also be extremely, extremely good sources of content. And I really consume, I consume a lot of articles. So as we mentioned earlier, I think the Why Books Don't Work by Andy Matuszek is extremely good. It's an essay to explain like what we said earlier about the problem with books. Then there is a book that I always go back to, is Awareness by Anthony DeMello, which was really a kind of a wake-up call for me, like in terms of life philosophy and, you know, what to pay attention to and what not to pay attention to. And maybe if I had to add something, I would say Studying Studies, which is a series of articles by Peter Attia, on how to read the scientific studies to understand and to be able to, you know, find the studies that are reliable and the other ones that are not, because I believe it's a huge problem in science right now, not to be able to
I was just looking at the field of dietetics and nutrition as well, because you always find contradictory studies which are really overwhelming, because if you're coming with an open mind as well, even the scientists are arguing with each other in terms of what is the most right way, and maybe the way in which the research itself is conducted might not be as credible as they imagine, right? So I see all these things happening, and we, as say the common people who are at least not say scientists in that regard, find it really difficult to kind of go through this whole thing and extract useful information which could be useful for
exactly. You know, this is really, we should always try to go to the source. Whether it's science, go to the paper, read the paper, you know, like go deep.
Go to Origin of Species and read mentioned, right?
Go to the origin, to the of the information. Don't read the big title for in a news magazine or whatever. Go to the study and understand it. So these series of articles is really good to get a good understanding. And I would add maybe like a podcast that I just discovered recently that I really enjoy is Philosophize This.
One of my favorites.
Extremely good. Yeah, yeah. I cannot believe that I just discovered it. But like yesterday I was walking in the streets of Paris and I couldn't believe how good it is. Like I listened to like four in a row. You know, it's just so good.
Yeah. I think you might have... listen to the recent episode by Max Weber on the Iron Cage, right?
Exactly.
Exactly.
It's really, you know, thought-provoking about progress and the future of our civilization, because you definitely see that there are some drawbacks, you know, with progress and with efficiency. It's really good to think about these topics, because, you know, without philosophy, we cannot have a fulfilled life.
I think for me... how philosophy has helped me a lot is in terms of giving me useful metaphors, because I think reality is too complex to kind of understand as much as you can, but you still have these abstract notions with metaphors, like the way he mentions the iron cage itself is a nice way to understand how the reality functions. and that acts as a guiding tool for you to like being more aware, right? So I see philosophy in that sense, and that has made me more interested in this field itself. And I guess this is an amazing podcast, what Philosophize This has done. And if you could probably like go, it actually is in a very chronological manner. So it like right from the first episode, it starts with the foundations, right from Socrates and Plato, yeah. Aristotle, and then it slowly goes towards the most contemporary philosophers. So yeah, that would be interesting because
I think that I'm going to start from the beginning. I'm going to go to the end of the pile and start from there. And I'm going to listen to them all. Honestly, it's so good.
Yeah. Also like really nice examples they give and a lot of stories. So philosophy doesn't really, it's not so boring as they imagine it.
Yeah, for sure. It's adapted to our time. And maybe the last thing that I really enjoyed it, as I was telling you last time we were talking, to learn more about India, is the two-part series on Reliance and NGO. It's like, it's very good. It's very, very good. There is this two-part series, Reliance, the origin, and Geo from oil to Geo.
Yeah, it's one of the most, it's like a behemoth in India in terms of how they have arisen from ashes. It's like a phoenix story. So yeah, I guess it's interesting that you also have kind of been curious about the Indian startup ecosystem. So
yeah,
I see in general a very curious mind and open to all possibilities. And I guess good luck with your work with Lifetizer as well. I'll share all the links on the episode so that others can also watch and read more about Mehdi's work. Thanks a lot, Mehdi, for joining.
Thank you so much, Reyes. It was a pleasure to be here with you today.
It was amazing conversation. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Bye.